Hey everybody, welcome to Sweater Weather, a podcast about Canadian arts and culture. Thanks so much for being here, our first live show. Naomi, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm good.
Very excited for this live show.
That's right.
Here at the Rose and Crown in Calgary.
That's right. I didn't introduce who I am.
No, go ahead.
My name's Aaron Giovannone. I'm a writer and professor.
And I'm Naomi Lewis. I'm a writer and editor.
We also have a guest with us today. He's a musician, an actor, a writer. He's a multi-talented artist. He was Calgary's inaugural Poet Laureate just a few years ago. And he's a good friend. Please welcome Chris Demeanor.
Thank you.
Chris, how you doing?
I'm feeling very mellow and mid-tempo this evening. Just like a certain person's music.
Beautiful. It's appropriate.
Have you been listening to Sarah McLachlan today?
All week.
Oh, good.
Nothing but.
Yeah, me too. Me too. All day today, nothing but Sarah McLachlan.
Our topic today, we've already mentioned it, it's Sarah McLachlan, singer-songwriter. She's released 9 studio albums. She's sold more than 40 million records worldwide. She was the founder of Lilith Fair, the women's music festival. She was the spokesperson for the most heart-wrenching SPCA commercial ever. She's a huge figure in 90s Canadiana, and she's the perfect topic for Sweater Weather, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Usually we start off like this. So what are your sort of earliest memories of Sarah McLachlan?
My earliest memory of Sarah McLachlan was, I think, 91, 92. It was the heyday of Much Music, Canada's video channel. And I recall vividly seeing for the first time, and many times after that, the video for Into the Fire, in which Sarah gets birthed from the mud like some sort of gorgeous orc. I was intrigued by that visual. I thought the song was pretty decent, and it was a really nice change of pace from all the fucking Blue Rodeo videos that I had to watch.
How about you, Naomi?
I do remember the moment that I noticed Sarah McLachlan for the first time for some reason. And I think it must have been 1989, which was when her first album came out, Touch. And there was this show, like pre-Much Music, called Video Hits with Samantha Fox. It was on TV at 5 o'clock.
It wasn't Much Music, though. It was another channel.
It was just a half-hour TV show where they showed videos. So, like, I'd get home from school. We had one TV in our house that was in my parents' bedroom. Mm-hmm. And I would, like, run up to their room, turn on the TV, and then I would watch TV for a grotesquely long time. And one of the shows I always watched was Video Hits. And they would just show, like, I guess not very many videos, because it wasn't a very long show. But anyway, Sarah McLachlan had a video. I feel like it was her first song that was a hit or whatever. It was called Vox, from the album Touch. And I think in the video, I don't know why I didn't watch it again to prepare for this, but I'm just relying on memory. She had this like short sort of like 80s hairstyle, but like punky 80s. And she was sitting at a piano, and I feel like there was like a lot of candles around her. And
that sounds like Sarah McLachlan.
And I loved it. Like, I just totally loved the song. And actually, I did listen to it again this weekend. It's still a really good song. I think it's still, it's kind, and it has like almost, I feel like it has a kind of East Coast kind of vibe to it a little bit. Like,
does it sound Kate Bushy to you? Those early ones are very much Kate Bush.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit.
And she is a Halifax girl, so that would make
sense. Yeah, and it sounds Haligonian.
Haligonian.
It sounds Haligonian. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Well, my earliest memories of Sarah McLachlan would have been 1993. It was, my sister was a huge fan, and she had also the biggest stereo in the house. So she would blast, I mean, it's weird, right, to say this? She'd blast Sarah McLachlan music, but she would, really loud. It'd just be, it was fumbling towards ecstasy, so it was that song Possession. Mm-hmm. There was also that song, the last track on that album is a song called Ice Cream. I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with this. I think that was applause for the food Ice Cream, which I also like. Big fan.
Yeah.
Your love is better than ice cream. My sister would play that song like over and over and over again.
Those are some pretty profound lyrics.
I've got a good story about ice cream. My partner Deborah Willis, who first of all, I should have started with this quote from her, because when I said I was doing this podcast, she said, "Sarah McLachlan, if you have a feeling and you want to feel it hard, listen to Sarah McLachlan." That's what an internationally renowned novelist says when they hear Sarah McLachlan is going to be on the table. But she was auditioning for a play in late elementary school, and she sang Ice Cream for the audition as loud as she could.
Ooh,
on
Debbie,
the stage.
Debbie did?
Yeah, she did.
Oh, my gosh.
And she got cast in the play as the girl who couldn't sing.
Oh, my God.
So her job in the play was to sing this song badly, and she did it beautifully, apparently.
Good for Debbie.
Yeah, she loved that song Ice Cream as well.
Mm. Amazing, amazing. Well, should we hop in to the life and times of Sarah McLachlan? Well, it's already been mentioned. Sarah McLachlan was born in Halifax in 1968. She's adopted. She was adopted by Dr. Jack McLachlan, a biology professor at Dalhousie University. He studied marine microalgae. And his wife, Doris McLachlan, she was an MA in English literature.
So the song Rhythm of the Sea kind of refers to both her parents, marine biology and literariness.
That's right. That's right. Her mother.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. And she, okay, well, we'll get to where she moves later, but hint, it's like the other coast where the other ocean is. Anyway, okay. She has two older brothers, Stuart and Ian. Her biological mother was Judy James, a Halifax visual artist. This fact that she was adopted was revealed to the public by author Judith Fitzgerald. She's the author of a bizarre, unauthorized biography from 1997. It's called Building a Mystery. I read it. It is really a nutty book. But there's actually, I looked up Judith Fitzgerald, the author, and I went down a wormhole following her life. She was like kind of an eccentric poet. There's no real biography for Sarah McLachlan yet. So she must have just been hanging on to those rights until she, you know, wants to publish the book or her own memoir, probably. Maybe she needs a ghostwriter, Naomi. What do you think?
I'd be willing.
Maybe after this episode.
I feel like it's not going to work out between us.
When Sarah was four, she played ukulele and sang for her mother's afternoon tea group. She studied classical guitar, piano, voice at the Maritime Conservatory of Music in Halifax. She won competitions and scholarships, including Nova Scotia's 1987 Kiwanis Music Festival. Yeah, so.
Makes sense.
She got an early music education. At school, she was nicknamed Medusa for her big curly hair. She said in interviews that she didn't look back at her time growing up fondly.
Because of that?
I guess she was bullied because of her hair.
I was bullied because of my hair too. I can understand how she felt.
So it sounds like you guys would get along just fine.
Yeah. I could write that part of her book from my heart.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you just stop at age 11.
That's right. Sarah McLachlan, if you're listening to this, just stop right now.
Well, she and I are both from the marginalized curly-haired community, so I feel like we would bond over that and then go forward from there.
She's also said that she was, quote, an average teenage rebel with a skateboard and bad attitude.
Really?
So she's also said that. So I don't know. I don't know what to make of that. So McLachlan told the Boston Globe in 1989, she was 19 at the time, "I used to listen to a lot of Joan Baez, Cat Stevens, Simon and Garfunkel. They were my mother's influence. And when I was 16, I started to listen to progressive music and New Wave by the Cocteau Twins and Kate Bush. Then I discovered Peter Gabriel, who is a god to me." So she loves Peter Gabriel.
She digs Peter Gabriel.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
McLaughlin attended Queen Elizabeth High School in Halifax, and she fronted a rock band called October Game. October Game had two albums. The first one's named Out of the Fog. The second one is named Out of the Fog 2.
I love that.
I'm just looking over at your notes here, and it looks like it's Out of the Fog 2, T-O-O.
That's right.
Is that right?
It's a pun on the number 2. The word
also
two.
Out of the fog.
Also out of the fog.
Great.
So in 1985, this band, what are they called again? October Game. They performed at Dalhousie University, and they opened for the Vancouver electronic band Moev. Do you know this band, Moev?
No, I've heard of them, but I don't know.
I hope I'm saying that right.
I think it is, yeah.
Okay, Mark Joett of Moev was immediately taken with McLaughlin, so a member of the band, loved McLaughlin. After the show, McLaughlin was offered a recording contract with the Network recording label in Vancouver. That was Moev's label. Mm. It was also the label of industrial music pioneer Skinny Puppy, future topic of Sweater Weather. Rod, you have to yell for that. That was free. Rod is a big Skinny Puppy fan. I put that in there just as for an applause line for Rod. All right. I can edit out all the stuff in between, so it'll sound perfect. So McLaughlin's parents wisely would not allow her to move to Vancouver because she was 17 at the time. She finished high school, attended NASCAD for 1 year, then in 1987, at the age of 19, moved to Vancouver and signed with Network. All right, there we are. Any comments so far? We've gotten through her early life. What do you think about young Sarah McLaughlin?
Well, I didn't know her, but I have been witness to a few of those occasions where somebody comes onto the scene and does like one gig, and people are scrambling to sign them, to get them. You know, I saw a similar thing with Tegan and Sarah here in Calgary.
Future topic of Sweater Weather.
They did they did a battle of the bands in Matt Hall at the university. And
you were there?
Yeah.
Fun.
And
of course,
yeah, and everybody went nuts. And the word went around, and within a week, I think, yeah, they were literally having, like, you know, bids. By labels to come join them. So I lived for a year with Leslie Feist and Alicia, the bass player from Placebo, which was an early punk band in Calgary. And I remember Leslie sort of poring over this contract for Placebo by a record company that essentially was saying quite explicitly, we just want your voice. Everybody else can go, but it's your voice that we want. So I think sometimes when a voice is heard, so in the case of Tegan and Sarah, this amazing sibling harmony, in the case of Feist, that amazing voice, in the case of Sarah McLaughlin, sometimes it's just, you know, a bulb goes off and everybody says, okay, this is something special.
Right.
And you know, it's no guarantee that the material is going to equal the voice.
Right.
Obviously, you know, that's just when the work begins. But
that's right. Yeah.
You know, in the case of her, that doesn't surprise me whatsoever because, you know, her money shot has been her voice.
and
that's why you hear on all of the songs. I mean, the voice is, you know, it's mixed, you know, twice as loud as, you know, the instruments, because it is so beautiful. I mean, it's an amazingly precise and, you know, mellifluous voice for sure.
Right. She's in Vancouver. She has a recording contract with Network, right? She moved down the street from Network's offices. She worked at a sandwich shop. And she started to try to write her first songs. So Sarah McLaughlin has never written a song before. So she has to do that now. So the label contracted musicians to collaborate with her, including 5440's drummer Daryl Newdorf and the Grapes of Wrath, their keyboardist Darren Phillips. So in 1988, she has an album. It's called Touch, and it's released by Network. The album went gold in Canada and spawned the singles Vox and Steaming. So you were talking about these songs.
Vox was the one I liked, yeah.
That's right. So it's, to me, it sounds very 80s, very, the influence of Kate Bush is like pretty obvious.
And Peter Gabriel too, that all makes so much sense.
See, I don't know Peter Gabriel's.
I loved Kate Bush and Peter Gabriel. And I had this friend when I was a kid whose dad was a DJ at the, you know, like the college radio station in Ottawa.
Yeah.
And he had this huge record collection. And for some reason, I was allowed to go over and like tape albums onto tapes. And so from there, I had like Kate Bush and Peter Gabriel and Prince and stuff like that. And I loved those tapes that I had. And then I also, so it makes sense to me now that when I heard Sarah McLachlan at first, I really, really liked it.
Yeah.
And also that you were saying she was kind of like rebellious and like had a skateboard and stuff. That makes sense too. Like for what I remember of that video, her look was kind of more of that type. Like it makes me wonder what happened later. Because she went in a very different direction.
She did. She went in a different direction, but she says...
Brett Wilson. She dated him.
Yeah. Okay, well, okay, you guys are going to have to tell me about it. Okay, that's for the future, though. Okay, so after that album was released, the American label Arista BMG picked her up with an 8-record deal. So she's gone big time.
Eight?
An eight record deal. That's what
that
I read.
Normal?
That's rare. Usually three or four at a time. Yeah.
Eight? Like, it's like a lifetime, isn't it?
It's been her whole career, I guess, because she has 9 studio albums. So that's been her whole career. McLachlan mentions that she had a lot of creative freedom at her Canadian label, which prepared her to fight off the corporate interference at the larger American label. She said they kept trying to change her and stuff, but she said that she always did what she wanted.
Did you say how they tried to change, what they were trying to turn her into?
They wanted her to be more dancey and stuff. Mm. That was mentioned. So her next album is in 1991. It's the album Solace. It's recorded between Montreal and New Orleans. Now, what happens to her is this. She starts working with producer Pierre Marchand. Pierre Marchand became McLachlan's longtime collaborator and producer, and he's been on every one of her albums since. McLachlan said in 1991 that Pierre Marchand, quote, "He made me sing lower, so my voice was closer to my speaking voice, and showed me more of my own personality. On the first record, I did a lot of classical wanking, you know, showing off what my voice can do." So I find that Marchand's production gives her songs like a quivering, immersive quality. I don't know if, like, there's a sound to Sarah McLachlan's records after this.
Like a warbliness, or?
It's immersive. I don't know. What do you think?
It is immersive, and I will again quote my partner, Deborah Willis, when she says, "It speaks to the body, not the brain."
Oh my gosh.
She doesn't talk about the feelings. She makes you feel the feelings along with her. So I think that is part of that immersive quality, and I'd agree with that assessment.
Oh.
Is that what you meant by immersive?
I guess so. Yes, that's right.
Yes, it is.
That's right. Beyond is exactly what I meant. So there are two singles on that album, Path of Thorns and Into the Fire. They broke into the top 40 in Canada. They charted in the US as well. The video for Path of Thorns, McLachlan performed in the nude. Of her early image, so you wanted to know about her change in image too. So of her early image, McLachlan says, "My manager at the time thought it was a good approach to be this ethereal, whimsical waif. It wasn't particularly easy to live up to. I think I disappointed a lot of people when they actually met me." So maybe that early version of her, it sounds like that wasn't actually natural to her.
That's so interesting, because I was thinking about it today, how I was really, like, whimsical waif probably described at the time, like, what I hoped I would grow up to be. And so I really, I hoped I would get to be a whimsical waif, like, surrounded by candles someday, you know, wearing, like, a long flowing gown. So that's it didn't work out for me. It sounds like it didn't work out for her either, because it's impossible to be that.
Well, and my brother-in-law, Greg, is a music promoter. And he did all of the shows in the 90s at Mac Hall Ballroom at University of Calgary. And he did a couple of Sarah McLachlan shows. So I asked him if he had any thoughts or memories about her. And he just sent me a quick text, because he had a show today. But he said she was incredibly hippie.
Oh,
really?
Which is interesting, because if she was sort of fighting a little bit more of the punk skater image and didn't think that was really her, in Greg's mind, she portrayed that. I mean, you know, he has a certain animosity towards anything mildly hippie, so I think it doesn't take much. I think you probably just have to wear patchouli and you're screwed. but he also I remember him saying that she liked to belch
really
quite a bit. And then I remember I was reading about Lilith Fair and someone one of the participants there said that she liked belching as well. Oh. So you wouldn't mention that if it was a man who liked to belch, I'm sure, but because she was a proud belching woman, I imagine it's news.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't fit the image of the whimsical waif.
It doesn't. I mean, I think of her as the like as the boss, you know, like Lilith Fair, very much like a woman in charge, you know. So I never really, I guess, because I didn't know Sarah McLachlan's earliest stuff, I didn't think of her as a waif, whimsical waif.
Well, it's funny because I kind of think of her as becoming more of a whimsical waif later when she had like the long flowing hair and more of like, I picture her almost like with an image like Gwyneth Paltrow has now, like long flowing hair and like long flowing white dresses or something like that. You can get a whiff of patchouli just looking at her.
So this is okay. In 1992, McLachlan said this about her creative process. Quote, I have to bring myself to a point of hysteria sometimes before anything good comes out. But that's when the good stuff comes up. When you push yourself so hard and so long that you're on the brink of bursting into tears. That's usually what happens. I usually just lose it. I burst into tears and bawl and bawl and bawl. And then 5 minutes later say, okay, that's the course.
What you do?
That's how before I can record any song, I need to cry or wreck something.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, that speaks to that point that Deborah had about feeling what she's feeling. So she's not, you know, she's not going through the motions, you know, I think that kind of emotional authenticity is something that resonates with people. If you look at any of the YouTube chats after one of her videos, it's people of all ages from all over the world saying how much this meant to them and help them get through their parents' death and help them, you know, at this difficult time in their life. Like, it means a lot to them. And that's not common.
It's that kind of music.
Yeah.
It is that kind of music.
So that doesn't surprise me. That's her process.
Yeah. So now it's 1993. She has a new album called Fumbling Towards Ecstasy. This is the one my sister played over and over and over again. This was the big commercial breakthrough. I don't know. I feel like people might know the song Possession. This was the first track and single from Fumbling Towards Ecstasy. Now, in this song, McLachlan adopts the voice of obsessive fans who wrote her letters. So this is what she says. Quote, I put myself into the rapist murderer's point of view. I wrote it from his perspective. I had to deal with that because it was really starting to freak me out. Some fan letters were getting really intense. A couple of them got a wee bit too intense and it started to affect my life. Things like running into them a couple of blocks from my house and saying they'd been there for a couple of days. It was pretty scary. I stopped answering my mail a long time ago. The lyrics to Possession, do we know them?
And I will be the one to hold you down, kiss you so hard,
your breath away.
Did you hear about what happened with one of the primary fellows who are you going to get to that?
Yeah, it's in my notes. Okay. It's in my notes. But yeah, like the song is.
I mean, I actually
like that song.
I recall when that came out, and I remember seeing an interview with her explaining that, and I thought that was again, you know, I think from a musical standpoint, I always I kind of found her. The kind of sameness of the mid-tempo approach of many of her songs a little bit. I was a bit ambivalent toward it, but that particular song, I thought it was a really interesting and I guess without thinking of a better word for it, a brave thing to sing about.
Yeah.
Because it is incredibly dark and honest. And I thought the subject matter of that was
was pretty profound for a pop song.
Did you know this song, Naomi?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
did you know what it was about? Because I didn't know what it was about.
Yeah, I did. I feel like somehow I must have seen an interview or something, and I think I just people were talking about it, how this song was, yeah, based on letters from stalkers.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, one of these fans, a stalker, his name is Yui Vandrei. He was an Ottawa, Ontario native. He sued McLaughlin for $250,000 in 1994, alleging that his love letters to her had been the basis of the song Possession. It was going to court.
I remember that, yeah.
He died by suicide before the case
oh
went
God.
To trial.
Really?
It's sad.
Such a weird story that he was like yeah. stalking her, sending her love letters. She stole his writing for
allegedly.
From the letter, allegedly.
Allegedly.
And then he sued her. Like, and then committed suicide over it. That's amazing. What a story.
I have a feeling if he'd survived, he wouldn't have won the case.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Well,
they would have thrown that out in a...
Would they? Like,
yeah.
Even if
it's ridiculous.
You want to know when
even if he did write those words and letters. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
It doesn't mean that you own
no,
them.
No,
yeah.
while he was around police people, they should have arrested him.
Yeah, really.
Anyway, no, I don't. But seriously, I think because it wasn't just him. It was a pastiche of like two or three different people, and taking phrases and words out of the context of the original meaning of something is not a plagiarism issue at all.
It's interesting. It kind of makes me wonder if he sued her like as a way to potentially meet her or like to get her attention.
Very likely, yeah. To just be part of, to have him be remain part of her life.
Yeah, and part of her story, which he is.
Okay, later editions of this album, they contain the 1995 single, I Will Remember You. This song was featured prominently on the soundtrack for the 1995 film, The Brothers McMullen, a film about three Irish-American brothers from Long Island. This is like Edward Burns' project, starring, directed, written by The Brothers McMullen. I just love it. It's good Irish-American boy. I guess McLaughlin is Irish. It's an MC, not an MAC. So it's an Irish name. Okay. I Will Remember You peaked at number one in the Canadian contemporary charts. With Fumbling Toward Ecstasy, Sarah McLachlan went on a world tour. Elizabeth Renzetti reviewed a Sarah McLachlan concert from this tour. She reported that McLachlan closed the concert by saying to the audience, "Thanks, it's been really, really therapeutic." Okay.
I find that funny.
Yeah, me too. I don't know. In an interview on this press tour, yeah, I don't know what this audience, they're all laughing at us.
Oh no, there they go.
Oh, there they go.
Come on, guys.
Okay, so.
I'm finding this really therapeutic, by the way.
Okay, so we're gonna. That's why we started a podcast. It's cheaper than therapy, okay.
Is it though?
I don't know, actually. In an interview on this press tour, McLachlan mentioned her favorite writers were Rilke, Wilfred Owen, Margaret Atwood, and Douglas Copeland. Douglas Copeland, a previous episode of Sweater Weather.
In which we trashed Douglas Copeland. Over the coals. But Margaret Atwood is another member of the curly hair community. So that might be.
Peggy, definitely. Yeah. Peggy Atwood, definitely. Fumbling Toward Ecstasy has gone 3 times platinum in the United States, 5 times platinum in Canada. It has sold 2.3 million copies. In 1997, McLachlan released what would be her biggest album ever, Surfacing.
The same title as a Margaret Atwood novel. Never thought of that before.
The title is a reference to the 1972 Margaret Atwood novel.
Which, can I tell you, my poetry professor in grad school said was the worst novel ever published.
My poetry professor in grad school said it was the best book that Margaret Atwood ever published.
Oh. Ooh, I wonder if they've ever met those two poetry professors, could battle it out.
Probably didn't. So, Surfacing featured 4 singles, Building a Mystery, Sweet Surrender, Adia, is that how it's said?
Adia.
And Angel. Now, okay. Now, we'll put Angel aside for a second here. I like the song Sweet Surrender. Mm-hmm. I used it in the promo for this episode, the little promo video that I put out on Instagram and stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, Sweet Surrender, I find it darkly moving. This is what I've written down. I find it darkly moving. But I have to admit that for years, I misheard the lyrics. I just found out yesterday that I've been singing it incorrectly the entire time. So these are the actual lyrics. I've crossed the last line from where I can't return, where every step I took in faith betrayed me. Now, that's the real lyrics. I thought the lyrics were, and I always sang it this way, I've crossed the landslide. From where I can't return. I think that's better. There's a better image. Yeah. You picture a
the
like
crossing
last
of a landslide.
Last
is an arresting
line?
Image.
That's not an image. Last line.
Yeah.
Landslide, you picture rocks.
That's hard to cross.
Grass, mud.
Yeah.
You can't cross that.
Well, you can if you're Sarah McLachlan.
Okay.
If I had a broken lawn chair.
Okay, well, despite not featuring my lyrics, the album hit number one in Canada and number two in the United States, and it sold 16 million copies.
Wow. That's...
It won 4 Junos, 2 Grammys, including the Grammy for Best Female Pop Vocalist Ooh. Performance. So, to support the 97 album surfacing, McLachlan launched Lilith Fair, the all-women's musician festival tour. Now, McLachlan had been told by concert promoters that you shouldn't feature two female acts in a row. Bucking this trend, this so-called wisdom, McLachlan went on a successful tour with vocalist Paula Cole in 1996. One of those engagements, they called it Lilith Fair, and that's where they eventually got the name for the entire festival. The name Lilith comes from Jewish lore. Lilith was Adam's first wife, who refused to be subservient to, quote, lay beneath him, unquote. That's what I read. Now, Lilith does not
should
appear...
Should be lie beneath him.
Oh, my God. Grammar corrected. I think it's, like, archaic.
No, that's just wrong. No one ever said that.
You're telling me the internet... Are you telling me the internet is wrong
yes,
about something?
Yes, I mean, she would lay, like, a tablecloth beneath him, maybe, or a blanket.
Maybe that's what she refused to do. Anyway... Lilith does not appear in the official Bible or Torah, but in several Midrashic texts. Those are commentaries on Hebrew scripture. Anything else about Lilith? No?
Lilith is a really neat figure. Like I remember when Lilith Fair first existed that I thought it was really cool that it was named after Lilith, who was supposed to be this, badass first wife of Adam who was cast out. So it's a pretty great name for a festival of female musicians.
I agree. I like the name a lot. So speaking about Lilith Fair in 97, McLachlan said, quote, there needs to be an alternative to that Lollapalooza cock rock. Lilith.
Fair.
We said a bad word.
We.
it's my fault now. All right.
Don't forget there's also Ozfest going on at the same time.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Ozfest.
What was that like?
We don't know anything about it. Ozfest? It was a heavy metal festival.
Oh, Ozfest.
So,
wow.
That was a cock rock festival.
Oh, my gosh.
So Lilith, this is McLachlan still. Lilith is really just a celebration of sisterhood. It's not about excluding men. I don't want them to feel ostracized. Men could participate, McLachlan said, quote, maybe as go-go boys in cages with butt floss.
Yeah. Woo! Yeah. I love that.
I don't know about this audience. You know? The kind of stuff they like.
Can I just tell you something? I had a boyfriend in my early 20s who really loved Sarah McLachlan and Lilith Fair, and he was really into knitting, and
he went to Lilith Fair?
He went to Lilith Fair, and he... had like a workshop where he taught men how to knit.
Oh.
So, okay. Yeah, there you go.
There we go. Did he? How many years did he do it?
I forget.
Okay.
Well, and obviously many of the tech people and the roadies and the other musicians were men, and I've heard reports that for many of them it was the best experience of their lives as far as a touring.
Oh yeah, I bet.
Yeah. I wouldn't doubt it. Lilith. I called her Lilith. Her name's Sarah McLachlan. Okay, she continues here. Quote, "It's my gig and I control what comes in, even pamphlets. Some radical feminist groups are so far out there. They would love to chop every man's dick off. I don't want to be advocating that. There needs..."
She doesn't want to advocate chopping every man's dick off? That's nice of her.
She's on the record.
Okay.
So Sarah McLachlan was responding to feminist critiques of Lilith Fair. Writer Angelina Malhorta Singh charged in a well-known article that, quote, McLachlan's homophobic coterie had, quote, disowned their lesbian predecessors by posing as the first independent all-female music festival. So there had been overtly more political, lesbian, more, I guess, overtly feminist, too, you would say, music festivals that I guess Sarah McLachlan didn't acknowledge.
Do you know who, like, some of the bands were that played at Lilith Fair? Because I don't even know. I just know the big ones.
I've listed the big ones here. Okay. Fiona Apple in the first. So it was for 3 years, right? Fiona Apple, Tracy Chapman, Jewel, Lisa Loeb.
Okay.
Indigo Girls, Sean Colvin.
So it wasn't like
Tracy Chapman.
Yeah.
Suzanne Vega.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it was like pretty. It was like very popular, mainstream.
There's sort of the main stage. So Sarah McLachlan would headline every night, and then there would sort of be the stars on the main stage. And then there were like three other subsidiary stages. So you'd get more up and coming artists, like you'd get Dar Williams, the folk singer, playing a smaller stage. And Lilith Fair was responsible for breaking some younger artists as well. Like Christina Aguilera was at one of the Lilith Fairs and played like a side stage. So, yeah, there was, it had a lot to do with kind of helping a lot of young women sort of embark on their careers. So, yeah.
You went to Lilith Fair?
No.
No?
Oh, never?
No, I never actually went to one, but I know lots of people who did.
Right.
They wouldn't stop talking.
Okay.
Did you go to Lilith Fair?
No, I never did. I feel like I had a snobby... So, as I've mentioned a few times on this podcast so far, at this period, like late 90s, early 2000s, like I was in my teens and 20s and I had this like snobbery about like only liking indie stuff or whatever. And so I wouldn't even consider going to Lilith Fair because it
wasn't
was, like,
indie enough.
No.
Okay.
Like that in my opinion then, and I feel like, as I've mentioned before, like I did miss out on lots of good stuff because of this really like.
Just too cool.
I was too cool. So
this was one of them.
This was one of them.
It seemed too commercial for you.
Yeah.
The dominant style of music the first year of Lilith Fair was coffee house pop. That's how it was described. That first year they did 35 North American dates. Now they went for another 2 years in 1998. Lilith Fair did 56 dates. There was a greater variety of music, including hip hop, R&B as well, so like Missy Elliott and Erykah Badu were, I believe, on that 1998 tour. In 1999, they went again. They did it again, but it went back down to 40 dates. So in 3 years, Lilith Fair made over 130 tour stops. It grossed $52 million. Now, McLachlan's manager in 1998 said this, "The plan is to establish Lilith as a summer staple that can be run profitably with or without McLachlan's direct participation well into the new millennium." The show did not do that, though. The show did not continue after the third year. Well, McLachlan cited exhaustion and wanting to start a family. So she was working. This was her full-time job for 3 years, right?
But it was supposed to be able to go on without her.
I suspect that the fair was not adequately profitable, considering the risk and expense of moving a festival around like that. The only numbers ever provided in the research I did are gross, not net. So their expenses are not, they're not talking about what their expenses were. So, and this is the final word on Lilith Fair from that era. This was according to Paula Cole. So Paula Cole was with McLachlan from the beginning. She was that first, like that preliminary tour to Lilith Fair with Sarah McLachlan, the two did together. So Paula Cole said that the festival began to feel corporate. At the same time, it was actually less commercially relevant. than the new crop of female pop singers at the time. So like at the turn of the century around 2000, we have Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, Jessica Simpson, and that's the dominant, I guess, like kind of, those are the dominant women musicians of the era. So.
Although it's interesting that Christina Aguilera got her start at Lilith mm-hmm. Fair.
She performed it.
That's what Chris just said.
Just on a side stage.
On a side stage.
Just like showed up and did like a song or two. And,
right. Well, this is according to Paula Cole, who I think is a more like folk.
Yeah,
do you
but
know
I mean,
her?
I think that stuff like that is bound to happen.
Yeah.
Whenever something becomes popular, and I think like so many things in popular culture, you don't want them to keep going. You want them to have a sweet, you know, clear run of time when there's a lot of enthusiasm for it. So many good things. You know,
yeah.
Die bad creative deaths when they're sort of dragged through the mud in the name of anything, whether it be money or that sort of sense of, you know, we're giving, you know, people opportunities. Because I think what something like that acts as is sort of a launching off point for other mini tours and other collaborations. Not to say that that many things maybe didn't went back to the same way that they were before, where, you know, people still wouldn't program two female artists together on the radio or still wouldn't, you know, have two headliners. Yeah. But I would like to think that Lilith Fair had a lot to do with perhaps shifting attitudes towards that in kind of the big money music world, you know?
Yeah, I think it probably showed there was an audience.
It proved that beyond a doubt.
Yeah. Right, and the whole like don't put two female performers back to back kind of blew that out of the water.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, go ahead.
What I found interesting in reading up a little bit about Lilith Fair was the resistance in the American South to having Planned Parenthood booths at the Lilith Fairs and how they even had to deal with bomb threats.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
What happens after Lilith Fair for Sarah McLachlan? She has a hiatus for her family. So in 1997, she married her drummer, Ashwin Sood. Sood is from Calgary. He was born in Britain to Indian parents who later moved to Canada. McLachlan has two daughters with Sood. The couple separated in 2008.
Okay.
I think I failed a little bit in my research for this because I did nothing. Just for some reason, W. Brett Wilson didn't come up.
That was the other thing that my brother-in-law Greg said in his text to me, other than her being incredibly hippie, was, and I couldn't believe she went out with Brett Wilson, even for a short time.
So it was a short time?
I think it was like 2008 or something like that.
After her divorce? Yeah. Maybe he was a rebound.
I think he might have been a rebound.
Okay.
And I think he's had a long tradition of like just knowing like how to strategically throw money at things to ingratiate himself to people, but then once they realize who he is, then they run away.
So. Should we tell people who W. Brett Wilson is? I mean, because that's a Calgary character, sort of, that people here know.
He's here tonight.
Oh, no.
Bring him out.
Come on out, Brett. We'd love to see you.
We've got some pipeline protesters waiting to be hanged.
We have a special Patreon tier for W. Brett Wilson.
We sure do.
Yeah, $1,000 a month from W. Brett Wilson. He was he kind of became nationally famous because of the Shark Tank.
Dragon's Den.
Dragon's Den was the CBC version of that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so what
do
I
So we don't know anything about
so,
that.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, people can be forgiven for making bad romantic choices.
Yes, I hope so.
Let's not beat her up over that.
Anything's okay if it's a rebound.
Anything.
Even Brett Wilson.
Even Brett Wilson. Now we're at 2006. She released Winter Song, a collection of Christmas music, which seems so natural for her. Why hadn't she done this before?
And of course it's called Winter Song. It's
the name of a song on it, Winter Song.
Oh. It's like one word, Winter Song.
And to
she likes the one word song titles.
I just picture her like in a flowing gown made out of like a white reindeer pelt.
That is indeed.
Although she wouldn't do that.
That's the album cover. It's a white gown.
Oh.
She's like a snow princess, like
right.
a snow queen.
But she wouldn't wear fur because she's.
No, that probably not that. Anybody know any Sarah McLachlan Christmas songs?
That one's lost on me.
Yeah, I actually listened a bit today. And it was very painful to the ear. I listened to her version of Away in a Manger. And it was horrible. I just, in my opinion, it sounded like something that would be playing in like Starbucks in the background around Christmas time.
Yeah.
You know, it had like a sort of jazzy.
It's not unfair to say this. Like, she's, like, her music is now, certainly, if it wasn't always, very adult contemporary. The kind that's safe to play in a dentist's office.
It gets
right?
turned into that, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the Christmas album, for sure.
For sure.
Starbucks and elevators.
Yeah. Starbucks and elevators.
Starbucks and elevators.
Yeah.
So, okay, this is the big moment. Maybe this is the thing, ultimately, that Sarah McLachlan is the most famous for. In 2006, she became a spokesperson for the Society for the Prevention and Care of Animals, first in British Columbia and then in the United States. Her song Angel played over footage of abused and injured animals, a dog who can't walk, like an orange cat with like one eye missing. I remember this so vividly. And she shows up in the commercial and she says, "Hi, I'm Sarah McLachlan. Will you be an angel for a helpless animal?" It's so she did a second version of this commercial in 2010 with a song called Answer. And then she says, "Hi, I'm Sarah McLachlan. Please say you'll be the answer for an innocent animal who's suffering right now." The commercial raised $30 million in the first 2 years of its release. It's the most successful fundraising effort ever for the SPCA. Oh my gosh, that commercial. Can't you, have you seen it, Naomi?
Yeah, for sure.
Oh my gosh.
It's very heart-rending. Even though I'm allergic to animals, I adopted like 15 after I saw that commercial.
And then immediately abandoned them.
And then I had to send them back to the SPCA.
You're like, "Oh, this cat only has one eye." Send it back.
Gross.
So sad.
It is so sad.
So
I'm against the cat only having one eye and not having a house.
So actually the update to the commercial was a lot softer. Like they didn't show as graphically abused animals, let's say.
Okay.
I think people couldn't, by 2010, they couldn't take it anymore. Now, in 2010, McLachlan released an album called Laws of Illusion. Now, to accompany the album release, she attempted to resurrect Lilith Fair in 2010.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, but it was not profitable. Ticket sales were poor. There were some Lilith VIP packages cost $750.
Wow.
Several artists canceled because they assumed they wouldn't be paid, and several dates were canceled as well. In the end, 13 poorly attended shows were performed.
One in Calgary.
Someone here.
Did you buy a ticket and then you didn't get to go? Oh, bummer.
I'm assuming that it was poorly attended. I assume. I'm not sure. She was the only one there. Beautiful. In 2013, McLachlan said this of the failure of Lilith Fair resurrection. Our intentions, in hindsight, weren't really pure. It's like, oh, this would be great to do again. I've got a new record out, and it worked last time to promote my record. We didn't look at how all those women who came to the shows in the 90s now have children and jobs and mortgages. Let's see here. She's released a few albums since. In 2014, an album called Shine On. It was inspired by her father's death. It debuted. All of these albums, they always debut number one in Canada, mm-hmm. like no matter what.
Yeah. Even her Christmas ones?
I'm not sure about the Christmas album. There's one called Wonderland from 2016.
That's a
Christmas album called Wonderland
from
2016. And we're almost at the end.
That would be a winter wonderland.
Winter wonderland.
That would be a winter wonderland.
Yeah, that's implied.
So in the last several years, McLachlan has stepped away from music. In a recent interview with Tom Power from CBC, she talks about disliking music today because it is derogatory towards women.
Music? All music is derogatory towards women? I don't understand.
Music she doesn't like.
Oh, like the music industry.
I'm not sure. I mean, she talks about disliking music because she finds it derogatory towards women. She calls it, quote, lowbrow. And she likes musicians who use their platforms for, quote, positivity. So, I don't know.
Hmm.
Anyway. Mm.
So, I don't understand her statement about music.
Yeah, I don't get
songs
that
have lyrics that are derogatory about women.
Yeah, but it sounds like she's saying she doesn't like music at all anymore.
She doesn't like popular music because it's derogatory
all
towards women.
All popular music.
Much of popular music. Okay. Yeah, that's what she's saying.
Well, she could have said that in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And
I mean, things change. Styles change.
Yeah.
She is, Chris, as you already mentioned, she's now heavily involved in music education. Mm-hmm. In 2007, with a $500,000 grant from the BC government, she started a music education outreach program in Vancouver, where she lives. In 2010, it became a permanent operation called the Sarah McLachlan School of Music. And this provide free music lessons to, quote, at-risk youth. And in 2016, the program opened in Edmonton as well. So I'm assuming like the Alberta government is now funding it too. They operate out of Rundle Elementary and East Glen High School in Edmonton.
That's
and
great.
I mean, that's nice. That's like a nice thing to do.
She covers all of the administrative costs.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
And then she just solicits donations for the actual programs in the schools.
Okay.
But it's all free, completely free.
It's all free.
You just have to apply. It's meant for like youth at risk.
Yeah.
And underprivileged kids.
I assume there's government funding for it. I mean, the original,
probably
there was
some.
Original
yeah.
grant. Yeah,
I imagine there probably is some.
If you're in Southern Ontario this weekend, Saturday, November 26th, the day that this episode actually is going to be available to the general public, Sarah McLachlan will be performing at Casinorama in Orillia, Canada's closest thing to Las Vegas, I guess.
Orillia?
Kind of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sweet.
So yeah. So that's it. That's nice. Sarah. That's Sarah McLachlan's life up until this weekend.
All right.
Up until the age of 11, when her hair caused teasing.
It's very traumatic to have someone pull your curl and it bounce back.
Okay.
I can understand why she's traumatized. Been there. It's awful.
Oh gosh.
Never got over it.
Final thoughts, by way of conclusion on Sarah McLachlan. What do we think of Sarah McLachlan in summary? Or is there something that you haven't said yet that you'd planned to say? I know, Naomi, you've got something in the chamber.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, with music is just following the little black dot, you know? And I think that Sarah McLachlan has made that black dot move up and down in some pretty interesting ways over the years. And I think that it's understandable between... just talking from a musician's perspective, with that cohesion with her producer, with the thoughtfulness that I think she puts into the inspiration behind her songs. So the fact that I think the goal that most musicians go for in the realm of pop music, let's call it pop music, is being clear and simple and direct without being trite. And I think that she accomplishes that in her songs. And I've always appreciated that about her work. So,
two thumbs up.
Oh, I didn't know we had a rating system here at Sweater Weather. But two thumbs
it's
up.
It's the same as sneak previews.
That's great. No, it's great. Thank you.
Well, now yeah, I feel really bad about what I'm about to say.
No, this is perfect. It shouldn't be any other way.
We value diversity of opinion.
And I'm not saying that I'm right. I'm just saying my emotional response to Sarah McLachlan is that I despise her music.
Oh, my God.
And
saved it for the end. She saved it for the end.
She didn't give me a chance before. I was trying not to wreck the show. But when I hear her music, I am filled with loathing and rage. I don't know why, but that's how it makes me feel. Like Debbie, Chris's partner, Deborah Willis, the lovely Debbie, who is also my friend.
This is not doxer.
She is. No, excuse me. She said that if you want to feel a feeling.
If you have a feeling and you want to feel it hard, listen to Sarah McLachlan.
Yeah, and
I understand that.
I can see that, but for some reason it does not work for me. I feel like Sarah McLachlan wants me to feel a feeling that I am very much not wanting to feel or that I'm incapable of feeling or...
You don't have time for it.
I just... really, really hate that feeling.
So
was it different?
So Okay. I'm gonna follow the happy medium maybe here. Like I'm ambivalent. Sarah McLachlan. I know that lots of people like her. I really did like those albums not from 1993 and 1997. I feel like that period of her music was, as I said, like darkly. What did I say? Darkly immersive or something. I did find that. I think there were still shadows in her music, if that makes sense. And since then, when I've dipped in and heard this or that, it's like it really is just
kind of Starbucks
elevator music. Yeah. So I think I do like Sarah McLachlan from the 90s.
Her first album is still good.
I did not dislike hearing my sister play Sarah McLachlan. You know, maybe my sister's watching this, and she probably still likes Sarah McLachlan a lot. I have to ask her about that, actually. But I understand that. I think Sarah McLachlan is very meaningful music to a lot of people.
Yeah, well, I did have like an ex who I was in a serious relationship with, who I did threaten to break up with if he listened to Sarah McLachlan when I was around.
So. Wow. Okay. Note to self. Okay, so I promised the audience that they would have an opportunity to ask us questions.
Yeah.
We have an extra microphone. Does somebody want to ask questions?
Sure. Do you want to tell us your name?
There we go. No. Just first name.
I'm Mark. I have a question for the panel.
Oh, thanks.
If you could choose between one, Celine Dion, Alanis Morissette, or Sarah McLachlan.
Okay. I know.
You had to choose one, right? Like absolutely one. Which one would you choose? Thank you.
Oh, Mark, great question. Thank you. I have thought about this. Like, listening to Sarah McLachlan this week, I was like, okay, do I like this better or worse than Alanis Morissette? And, like, I like it a lot less than Alanis Morissette. So Celine Dion, a future topic of sweater weather, we haven't done yet, so I haven't really dug deep into that. My sense is not for me, probably. I don't want to assume, but I'm going to say Alanis Morissette, number one.
I agree. I would also choose Alanis Morissette. The other two both fill me with similar loathing.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
When I hear their songs. Celine, not as much as Sarah McLachlan. But Alanis Morissette is okay, so I'm going to pick Alanis.
You know, I love Alanis's ferocity and honesty, and I like Sarah for the reasons I mentioned, but I don't think the world could exist as it does without Celine Dion. I think she's... She's like the pyramids of Giza. I think she just needs to be here.
That's such a good point, because we are both being selfish, just picking the one that we want to listen to. But you're like, what's best for the world?
Exactly.
Yeah.
What's best for Vegas? That's. Yeah.
I mean, Celine is like an institution.
Yeah, she is. It's true.
Yeah. So.
Like nuclear weapons.
She's part of the infrastructure.
Yeah, the fabric of reality.
Yeah. Okay.
That's it.
So that was any more questions? Anybody else want to come up and ask a question?
I'd like to hear from whoever went to Lilith Fair.
Oh yeah. So just step on this side of the. There we go. Perfect. Hi. So here's a question from Sherry.
I wasn't going to say I had questions, but I was the lone person in the crowd that had been to Lilith Fair.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it was the 2010 revival version, and I was the only person there. But since you guys all decide to crap on her, I feel like she needs some defense.
Yeah, go for it.
When I was, 16 in 1990, whatever it was, your angsty teen years, those were the feelings that you felt, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in 2010, when she came back, I know it could be a real feminist, and it was all diluted, and it was fine. But, it was nice to have a place to go where there were multiple women in a row singing. And yeah, it was Sheryl Crow, and I'm pretty sure Erykah Badu was there, because that was amazing. It was like, she did make you feel those feelings, whether they were rage or whether they were just like 16-year-old teen angst, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought she needed some props. Like maybe she got diluted older when she got older. Maybe there was some toxic positivity later that enabled a crappy winter Christmas whatever album.
Toxic positivity. I like that
right?
phrase.
Yeah, that's good.
I like that phrase.
Yeah, but when we were 16 and it was real toxicity and real negativity, and she really brought that out, like. Sorry, it's formative. Sarah McLachlan's formative.
That's fair. Yeah.
Sarah was one of those people who did music and art, right? She, like, all of her albums had her own actual art and drawing in them, and so, which I didn't hear anybody talk about today. Oh, so yeah. I just wanted to say, have you looked at her album art? And it's, you know, she just really embraced the artistic stuff. So
I know she directed her own video. She directed the Possession video. Yeah.
Yeah. It was all really amazing. Yeah. Right. Like her as a young person in the 90s, looking up to women who could be vulnerable and artistic and powerful in Canada.
Yeah.
Right. It's pretty amazing. Even if, it gets alluded a little bit, that it was pretty amazing in the 90s to have that kind of a role model. So I think that needs to be recognized and acknowledged. And, you know, she's got all my money, so it's fine.
Thank you, Sherry.
Thanks, Sherry. Yeah.
That
thanks.
Wasn't a question, but.
No, I'm really glad you came up and said that. That's there. Great.
Thank you. That's great. Yeah, thanks. Here at the end of the episode, we usually ask our guests what they're up to. What are your current or upcoming projects you'd like to plug, Chris?
I'm working on a new record called Songs for My Father to Fall Asleep To.
Very nice.
So I'm trying to channel the great Sarah McLachlan as I write these compositions and record them and, of course, cry before each take. And it's turning out really well so far.
I hope you've been crying a lot.
Oh.
It's great to hear.
Yeah.
Wonderful. That's nice.
How does it sound great?
And do you know when
that'll be out in probably April or May of next year?
Oh, great. Yeah. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Any plugs, Naomi?
Uh-oh. No, I'm still writing the same thing I've been writing for a few years, and someday I'll finish it.
It's very good.
Thank you.
It's on its way. All right. Well, that really does bring us to the end. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me here. Cheers. Thank you.
Naomi, thank you for subjecting yourself to Sarah McLachlan's music for this.
Thank you for making me give her another chance.
Thanks to the Rose and Crown Pub for hosting us. And thank you, most of all, to the audience. Thank you so much for being here at our first live show. And thank you for watching and listening out there. And we'll see you next time.
All right.